Welcome to the MS Dev Show, episode number 165. This episode is from our three-part special from that conference in Wisconsin Dells.
This episode of the MS Dev Show is brought to you by Espose, the market leader of .NET and Java APIs for file business formats. Natively work with DocX, XSLX, PPT, PDF, MSG, MPP, image formats, and many more. Raygun gives you complete visibility on errors, crashes, and performance problems affecting your end users. Replicate issues in seconds rather than digging through log files or having to rely on users to report errors or crashes. Raygun gives you a window into how users are really experiencing your software applications. Check it out today at raygun.com. Now we're talking to Keith Casey again, and he is the API problem solver at Okta and chief troublemaker in life.
Again.
Wow. I feel welcome on this.
Yeah, what's going on, Carl?
Wow.
No, I think it's just a preview of things to come in this discussion.
He did scare the crap out of us last time. So.
Yeah, that was fun, though.
That was my last day on Facebook.
That's a good thing. That's
yeah.
Good thing.
So what's been going on?
Oh, geez. Since last year?
Let's see. No, that was 2 years ago.
Was it two years ago already?
Oh, so I wasn't here last year. So that would have been Carl talking to you.
Okay.
So I got 1 year, a 1 year break.
Left a company, joined a company called Okta. We do identity management in the cloud and like single sign on. And my product is OAuth as a service. We had a son in there, me and my wife, not me and Okta. let's see.
That would be awkward.
Half Keith, half Okta. Yeah.
That would be kind of weird. Yeah. Yeah. And just generally running amok and generally getting paid for it. It's kind of a good combination.
Okay.
So you're giving a talk later on this week. Your API sucks.
It's actually only 12 reasons why your API 12. Sucks.
So for some reason, I have a feeling you have more than 12, though.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's just a matter of like which 12 do I use in most scenarios. So I tend to focus heavily on documentation because that's an easy one. But from there, I get creative.
All right. So can you preview your talk for us here
even,
a little bit.
Even though it's already happened.
Even though it's already happened.
Due to the magic of podcast.
Well, you're assuming I've written it. I mean, I've got like almost 48 hours, so I have to give it. So that's
very true.
Yeah, so I focus on documentation. One, like, are your docs complete? Are they accurate? Code samples. Are code samples complete? Are they copy, paste, tweak, and execute? Like where you only have to really replace credentials. Then I get into things like, how's logging work? Like when I'm running into an error with your API, how do I debug it? Like, do I just have to like kind of hope for the best, or is there actually like a debugging log I can step through? But probably the number 12 reason, and the one I think is by far the most important, is do you have a business model? Because there's a lot of APIs out there that launch, they use things, they do things, and it's a cool API, it's really useful, but nobody's paying for it.
And
there's no pricing.
Yeah.
And therefore, when I start depending upon your API that you're not charging for, eventually I'm going to become dependent upon it and it's going to disappear.
Yeah. I mean, it's basically guaranteed to disappear. And there's a lot of API companies that are out there that launch that never really figured out a pricing model. And we're shooting ourselves in the foot long term.
Well, yeah, because then they have ongoing costs. So there's a big company that I work with, and they have multiple products. And it's kind of interesting because talking to the one team, talking about their API, and they're like, yeah, we want to have an API and we're going to charge for it. Cause with their business, the data is the thing that's valuable.
Yeah.
So basically their API, they can sell access to it because that's access to the data.
Yeah.
And then I go to a different division in the exact same company. It's like, hey, you should open up your API and charge for it. And they're like, over my dead body. Like nobody's ever getting access to this. Like you have to use our software, you know, cause they're in their case, like the data is not the valuable thing.
Mm-hmm.
It's all the other stuff. So, it's just a totally, holy cow. Like the walls are coming down here. So in there, you know, it's interesting seeing like on different business models an API makes sense or it doesn't make sense.
Well, and I tell companies that I advise or I work with or whatever is that there's data that you have and you have better organized than anybody else. That could be valuable. And then there's features and functionalities that you do that other people can't do, or they can't do it at the sort of price scale that you're doing. So I always go to like Major League Baseball. Major League Baseball has an API for their data. That's incredibly valuable data. That's what, 100 years worth of data now that, you know what, you're not going to organize yourself. You're not going to collect it and all that. So that's incredibly valuable. And then you go to, on the flip side of service like Twilio, disclosure, I used to work there, being able to send a text message, make a phone call that actually, that's really useful. And building that infrastructure yourself is a pain in the butt.
Yeah.
So paying 1 cent a message or whatever is actually the better approach.
Yep. It's worth it for everybody involved.
Yeah, absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly.
So I noticed on your badge there, you got something underneath your name. It says Troublemaker.
Troublemaker. Oh, yeah. I wonder who put that there.
Yeah, so you said you've been up to some shenanigans.
I don't know if I use the word shenanigans. That might get me in trouble.
Oh, let me turn off the recorder.
Oh, okay. Well, now that the recording's off, yeah. Let me actually talk about what I've been doing lately. Last time I was here, yep. 2 years ago, I guess, freaked everybody out. We were talking about like how to share data, the inappropriate amount of data that people are sharing, and how with a little bit of diligence and forethought, you can connect those data, those data points. And so one of the scenarios I always run through is when a startup is launched and they say, oh, we're a stealth startup, mm-hmm. it's trying to uncloak what they're doing. Which is actually really easy because the vast majority of people don't take a job totally unrelated to their previous job.
Right. Yep.
Most people get their next job based on what they did their previous job.
Yeah.
It might be a level up. It might be a step forward, but it's basically the same.
So when Apple starts hiring people that used to be like autonomous car engineers,
we can make an educated guess. We can make a very educated guess on, hey, what are they doing?
They're probably retraining all of them.
Yeah, they're retraining them.
Yeah, that's how it works.
Yeah.
Elevator repairs.
Yeah, yeah, iTunes exactly. Musicians, yeah. Obviously.
Internal legal.
Yeah. So there's like that side of things. So that's what I was here 2 years to talk about. In the last couple of years, I've been working more in terms of what's called affinity groups. Mm-hmm. So an affinity group is a group of people that all have some common interest and some common bond. The fact that we're all here at this conference. Yeah, exactly. The fact that we're all here at that conference means that we all have an affinity towards technology.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Odds are we all have an affinity, or most of us have an affinity towards web development. We have an affinity towards, not myself, but other people, Visual Studio. Like you can say, because there's this one common thread, there's a bunch of adjacent ones that are highly likely. So I started applying this in nefarious ways. Recording's still off, right?
Yeah, of course.
Okay. Absolutely.
And to be totally serious here. Let's set aside jokes. There was a child pornography ring that was busted in New Jersey about a year and a half ago. And they published the 18 people's names. And so me being the guy I am, I was like, well, let's find their social media profiles. Mm-hmm. Let's see where they interact online. And I found meetup groups that they're of 18 of them, 13 were all members of these 6 meetup groups. Mm. I was like, okay, based on affinity theory,
mm-hmm. right.
If there's these 13 people who all have these, I think it was 6 groups in common.
Yeah.
That's vaguely suspicious.
Probably not like enough to hold up in court, but
no, it's not enough to hold up. No. It's not a sign of any guilt.
Yeah, but it makes you go.
And it is the definition of guilt by association. Totally.
Yeah.
But then I started looking at what other people were common among all those groups.
Yeah.
Because if you're a member of 6 different meetups and your buddy's a member of 5 of those meetups and somebody else is a member of 6 of those meetups, odds are you have a lot of things in common.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So I started digging on that and I found a list of 4 additional people that were members of all the same groups.
Oh, my God.
And actually interacted with some of those people in public channels. And that was the kind of thing that I'm like, well, this deserves a little bit more attention.
Yeah.
It's not a sign of guilt.
Yeah.
It's absolutely not.
Yeah.
It's never going to hold up in court. But it's the kind of thing where, well, wait a minute. There was just a break-in at that house, and that guy was carrying a TV down the street.
Yeah.
Let's stop and find out what's going on.
Right.
So I used to work in law enforcement circles, so I contacted some people I knew and said, hey, look, there's these 4 people. Here are the threads they have in common. You might want to go check them out.
Yeah.
And so that's you know, using my powers for good. That's the one time I did that.
The one time?
Did I say that all? We're not recording, so I'm fine.
Yeah.
But that's the kind of thing I look at, because there are nasty, disgusting, evil people in this world, and you know, if we can sweep a couple of them up and make sure that they're not spreading that, that's even better.
Yeah. Did you ever hear if anything happened then? Or?
If there was, I would never hear about it until an actual like indictment or prosecution or something happens. So.
I gotcha. Okay. That makes sense.
Yeah.
Well, that's good. That's good.
And I know some people are really nervous about like what, like a minority report kind of thing of what happens when we convict things. And that's a totally valid concern. But at the same time, I think there's some trade-offs that happen.
Well, and then you were like looking into those groups, right? So now some machine learning algorithm starts starts looking at, okay, who all, what kind of probability scores can we assign to people? And now all of a sudden you're in that group.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I'm not a member of any of those groups. Yeah. And I didn't hang out with any of those people or interact with any of them. But it's the kind of thing that these are the kind of things we need to at least be aware of that are out there.
Yeah. That's really interesting. Well, I mean, I think, you know, it's funny because you say like you're a troublemaker and like that's like the one good thing you did. But, you know, just in general, just the education of on all these topics is obviously insanely valuable. And the information about Facebook and how people are just giving away all this information.
Yeah. And I've got kids that are underage, so I won't give any more details because, you know, privacy. But the idea is that if I can educate people of, hey, look, here's what you're putting out there. Here's how this could be potentially used against you. I'm focused on like teaching my kids, hey, look, when you say this, when you put this out there, it doesn't just disappear.
Yeah.
This could live on in perpetuity. Mm-hmm. So just be aware. And, you know, odds are your teachers could see it. Your friends could see it. Like, just be aware it's out there.
Well, that I mean, I don't want to get too far down this tangent, but I guess, like, what should I be telling my kids then? Like, so really the question is, like, what are you telling your kids? Because, you know, I hear people talking about, like, internet safety all the time, but I think they have no clue what they're talking about.
Yeah.
You actually know what you're talking about, so I want to hear what you say.
So in terms of, like, geography, I say never say anything more specific than South Austin.
Okay.
You know, so that covers a couple hundred thousand people, a bunch of neighborhoods.
So I tell my kids that.
Yeah, never post pictures of our street, our house, the car.
Yeah.
People post pictures of the car and forget about things like license plates and backgrounds. And with Google Street View, you can actually do a lot of like hunting and figuring out, okay, this is where it is. There's a thing, Shia LaBeouf had the thing where he had the flag of people not invite us.
You got to talk about this because I don't think we talked.
Oh, it's fantastic.
Okay. So walk us through this one because I thought this was fascinating.
So Shia LaBeouf, after the election, by some definitions, completely lost his mind, to be generous. So he had a flag that said, he will not divide us, talking about Trump. Yeah. And so he decided to do this performance art thing where he stuck it on the top of a flagpole with a webcam pointing at the camera, at the flag, and just said, this is going to be up until Trump leaves office. Okay, that's interesting. Well, the interesting thing about that is that I just got handed another troublemaker badge, so now I've got two.
He's over.
It's in a different color, though.
Yeah, it's in a different color.
Different font.
So he put this flag up and has had the webcam pointed and said, this will be up for the duration of the Trump presidency. Well, and then some people on 4chan and all that sort of stuff start watching it, saying, where is this thing?
Yeah.
And at one point, they managed to see planes flying overhead.
Yeah.
And they're like, well, wait a minute. We know what time it is because it was a webcam pointed at the sky. So they're like, we know roughly what the longitude is because it's getting light at this time, getting dark at this time. Because the angle of the planes, they're able to pull up flight records and find out it's roughly in this region. So they had it locked onto a handful of square miles. Then they dug through Shia LaBeouf's Twitter profile and they found that he tweeted at being at this restaurant nearby, like about the time that it went up. So they're like, okay, it's probably in this particular region. Then they had guys go out in the field, like driving around these country roads, honking their horn.
Yeah, to see if they could hear
it. And once they heard it through the webcam, they're like, there it is. So then they zoomed in with Google Maps, and they found that the farm that they thought it was on, they saw a flagpole sitting there.
Yeah.
On a Google Maps view that must have been a couple years old. Yep. And then somebody went out and stole it. And it's the thing is, it took like 18 hours.
Yeah.
This was not like this was like CSI level kind of thing where they're like, hey, we have these two clues. Let's figure this out. And then he did it again in this cabin in Norway or Sweden or something where he just had it hanging on the wall. And so because the running gag was like, oh, well, he needs to put in a room where there's no background. There's no windows. There's no light. And so he put it in this cabin where you could see like the wall behind it. You could see the furniture, but the webcam was just pointed there. Well, then they dug again and they found, well, he was tweeting about being in this particular town. And then they found it was a travel town, like a tourist town.
Yeah.
So they had all these cabins. Of course, there are pictures of the cabins. So they had people going through all these pictures of cabins till they found one that the wood grain matched the wood grain from the stream. And somebody went and stole it.
So one of the things I think that is really interesting about this, too, is you mentioned Google Maps. And it used to be, like you said, it took a few years to update.
Yeah.
But I've noticed they've been updating much more frequently.
Yes.
It used to be like you'd see it was like 4 or 5 years behind, then like 2. I've noticed that it's for my particular property that I own, it's changed twice this year already.
Oh, wow.
They've updated it. So they're really getting quick with some of that, which makes some of these things that you're talking about all the time
that much easier.
Much easier to do.
Yeah. Yeah, it's disturbing on what you put out there. So you think, oh, well, I'll lock this down and nobody will find this thing?
Yep.
No, they will find that thing. They will find that thing. All it takes is annoying the right group and they will find it.
Has enough persistence.
Yes. The 4chan team calls it, or not team, but the group calls it weaponized autism, which is kind of offensive, but at the same time, it's that extreme focus to the point where it's like nothing else in the world matters except this thing.
Yeah. So this is actually my old house on Google Maps. Yeah. So there's me, my son.
Oh,
the
you're
dog.
Actually in the street
view
picture.
And we're blued out. Yeah. I saw the car drive by and we ran out. But nice. now it's, well, I should say it's not, I guess it's not easy to track me down, but you can sort of confirm if you knew what. If
oh,
you
yeah.
Knew what
yeah.
But I mean, you couple that with like being able to automate that API and do face detection. If somebody already knows what you look like because we put a picture of you on the MSDevShow website.
Yeah. To Google's credit, they did blur it out.
Yeah. Google's really good about blurring faces and things like that.
Yeah.
But it raises a lot of issues because maybe I don't need to know your face. Maybe I know you drive a 2009 Honda Civic.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Blur out the license plate or not, I still will recognize that car.
Yeah. So I still don't know what to tell my kids. Don't put a flag on the internet.
Yeah, don't put a flag on the internet. Don't annoy 4chan. It's all about being very deliberate in what you share.
Yeah.
And when you do things like post pictures online and stuff, if you can avoid identifying your kids, avoid it. If you can avoid showing any background, like establishing things like down your street or your car or your house or anything like that, just avoid it. Backyards are pretty safe because there's unlikely to be Google Street Views of that.
Yeah.
It's a lot harder to figure out. Is it impossible? Absolutely not.
Yeah.
In our particular case, like our second son, we tell him like, you know, don't give any of this information. Don't talk like who your parents are. Like it's just unnecessary.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we're gonna send you a bunch of MS DevShow swag. What's your home address?
1600 Pennsylvania Avenue, 20036.
I was gonna say, is it 90210? Is the zip code?
Well, I did this thing a few years ago, and apparently 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue has more domain names registered to it than anywhere else.
Oh, that's funny.
But then at the same time, 90210 has more domains like registered in that zip code than anywhere else.
Yeah.
Because it's the one zip code people know all over the world.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. I don't know. So I don't know what to tell my kids, and I feel like they really just should not anger anybody because I don't want anybody coming after them.
That's a whole other thing. Anger online sells for some reason.
Yeah. So, getting back to the session. So
APIs.
Yeah. So what do you talk about in the session then? So you were talking about, you know, like the top 10 or the top 12 list of why it sucks. I'm not sure how far we got in that list.
I gave a couple of them. Yeah.
Monetization.
Monetization is the big one for me that I feel like in the last two or three years I've been like talking about this pretty publicly. Like people just haven't been thinking about it. Like there was a lot of money sloshing around in venture capital circles and you could do dumb stuff. You know, you need to cut that out.
I want an API. Here's money.
Yeah, exactly.
Which actually brings up a good point. I mean, should I, you know, like at what point should I even make an API?
So let me actually answer that with another thing.
Sure.
And on Wednesday afternoon, I'm giving a second session of projects are not products. From the developer perspective, going from the point where we have an interesting project, like the code works and everything, how do we turn that into a product that people actually pay for?
Yeah.
So that's kind of like the two talks mesh really well.
Such a good point too, because like creating something and then like sort of finishing it, you're only like 10% of the way there to actually have a product.
Yes. It's really easy to like slap some code together and like put a website up.
Yep.
It's a lot harder to. I was just handed yet another troublemaker label. So I've got two in front of me, one on my badge, and it's handwritten on my badge by myself.
Is there some kind of joke or something here?
No, I think
we're
it's just
self-fulfilling prophecy.
It's truth in advertising.
Do you know these people?
So far, yes.
Okay.
So far, yes.
Okay.
I know we launch these things. We launch these projects. We call them products. We want people to give us money for them.
Okay.
But if you look at the things that we launch, you would never give you money on it.
Right.
Like, I hit a website and I'm like, wow, this sucks. Why would I ever give you money on this? Yeah. This is awful. There's no support. There's no, like, why would I use this?
Yeah.
What's the value to me? Yeah. Why would I give you money?
Well, I think people are just trying to put stuff out there to see what sticks.
Yeah.
I'm not justifying it. I'm just saying, like, I think that's what's going on.
But the thing that drives me nuts is that in a lot of these cases, like, just a tiny bit of effort, like 30, 45 minutes worth of effort would actually, like, increase these things and make it more likely you get money.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's just frustrating.
I'm bored. I'm on the next thing.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, absolutely. And so now if it's an API and you've now built something on that API, now you're dependent on it, and this was a project because you were bored and you thought it was cool, yeah, you just screwed me.
Yeah.
Like, long term, you just screwed me.
Yep.
And potentially my organization, right?
Yep.
So, yeah, it's frustrating. Yeah,
it solves my problem. I'm going to build on it.
Yes. And it solved my problem until 2 months from now when somebody just shut off the Heroku instance.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Right, so where can people who are interested in finding more about Keith, where can they go to find?
He's not going
to
tell you.
You cannot find information about me anywhere online. I've successfully locked that down. I'm Casey Software, Casey Software, just about everywhere. Twitter, LinkedIn, Skype, all those fun sorts of places.
Awesome. Yeah. Nice having you on again.
Yeah, thanks for coming on.
Espose offers a powerful set of file management APIs with which developers can create applications, which can create, open, edit, and save the majority of popular business file formats. Their product range supports a multitude of file formats, including Word documents, Excel spreadsheets, PowerPoint presentations, PDF documents, OneNote, Outlook, Project, Visio files, popular image formats, and many others. Espose produces APIs for .NET, Java, and the cloud, which can be utilized in almost any modern language available today. Visit espose.com for a free 30-day no-limitations trial, and if you get stuck, message the friendly support team for help. All technical support is offered free of charge. And remember, if you are a lucky winner, you will receive a free developer small business license for Espose.net, a powerful toolkit for working with Word documents in your applications.
Right now we're talking to Annie Bougie. She's a senior developer at Concurrency, a consulting company.
Hey, everybody.
Hey. So what kinds of things have been top of mind for you? Because I know we were talking earlier and it was like database, database, database. So you're like the database person now?
I guess so. I mean, I do a lot of other things too, but that's kind of one of the things that interests me. And one of the reasons why it interests me so much is because it's one area that if you fail, your performance is going to be really bad. So it's an important area to get right.
Yeah. So how did you start to get into that? Because I know... when I was consulting for a while, I started getting sucked into like database performance issues. So is that how it happened, or has it been more proactive than that? I mean, have you gone in there to like write database interfaces and work with different databases, or has it been more like help, everything's broken and performing poorly?
Actually, a little bit of both. I've taken it upon myself to learn like all the different types of databases, just because it's really cool, the things that are happening in the market these days. I mean, things are changing so much. And now, the so-called NoSQL movement, which I think is kind of a funny word. But, there's so many more options. I mean, I've been doing this for like 25 years. And, back in the day, the question was never, well, which database option should I choose? It was, which relational database should I choose, MySQL, should I choose SQL? And now there's so many more options, and I think that's something developers need to think about more, is how can they use some of these so-called newer options to solve problems that exist, because no one option is perfect. So if you can combine them, then you can get the best performance and the best result.
So what kind of things should we really be thinking of or having top of mind when we're looking at all these different storage options?
One of the places to start is how are you going to, reading and writing your data? How are you going to get your data back, and how are you going to be writing to your data, and what is the frequency? So if... you're going to be needing to store like a whole bunch of records all at once, you know, that can overload like SQL Server and, you know, lead to, you know, errors and stuff like that. So, you know, that might not be the best thing.
I have a little project where I'm using SQL Server right now, and I'm definitely running into that. Definitely just shoving way more in there than it can handle. Mm-hmm. And it's definitely affecting performance. So I can definitely see where that's an issue.
And then obviously, like, the look of the data and the shape of the data, too, like structured versus unstructured. And, you know, I see people, you know, like, I know, like, SQL Server has this option where you can take, like, JSON data and you can kind of shove unstructured data into a structured database. I guess you can't really do the opposite, right? I mean, I guess you can take structured data and shove it into an unstructured database, but, like, I don't know, like...
Yeah, it would probably still be structured at the end, but...
I mean, the whole world, it's just, like, all of development, right? It used to be so simple. It's like, I'm going to use one of the three languages available to me, and I'm going to use one of the, you know, three databases available to me. So I don't even, like, know where to start now. So you mentioned, like, choosing kind of the right database for the job.
Yeah. Like, you know, each of the different types of databases, I'm just going to, you know, categorize them. You have the relational databases. Then you have your document database store. You have your table storage, which is basically like a glorified dictionary in the cloud. You have your graph databases, and then the column family types of databases. So they all have their strengths and weaknesses. So if you need like really good transactional support and you do a lot of ad hoc reporting all the time, you know, SQL database is great for that. Mm-hmm. If you need to scale out globally and you have a lot of, you know, hierarchical records, then probably a document database store is going to be good for that.
And if I choose the wrong one, like how bad is that? If I just totally screw that up?
You can choose the right one and still have a really bad result.
Okay.
If you don't, you know, set it up correctly. If you choose the wrong one, I don't know if there's really, it's one of those things, is there really a real right or wrong? You know, then you'd probably have to do some refactoring. Yeah. Like if it really was a bad fit, then you'd probably have to do some refactoring or maybe even change your data store.
Yeah, because I'm just thinking, like, I always get paralyzed before I write something because you know, I'm just like, oh, well, I need to pick my database, right? And I'm just like, should I pick Cosmos? Should I pick SQL Server? And then like 3 weeks has gone by and I'm like, I didn't really want to work on that project anyway. You know, that's like the unfortunate reality. So like, should I, you know, next time I'll just come to you, but.
Well, but you know, why
should
pick
I just pick one?
Or? Why just pick one?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, the whole polyglot database movement, I guess, if it's a movement, is to choose which parts of your system should use which database. So, I mean, we typically think of our projects in layers. You know, you have your database layer, you have your business logic layer, and then your presentation layer. But you also need to think about intersecting that vertically. So taking one whole part of it and putting it in one data store. For example, you know, utilizing Redis cache.
Yeah.
Some areas where Redis cache can fit in is for adding like an index onto like Azure Table Store.
Okay.
So you can have a really fast lookup and then still be able to retrieve that record on the document key, which is what table storage is really good at. And like searching on your non-key fields is really bad at. So you can do that. If you need like on comments, like maybe the first 100 comments are in Redis cache, so you get those loaded up really quickly. And then, you know, when the person has read through all that and they want more, you know, the spinny thing, they've already read like that many comments, so waiting a couple more seconds isn't a big deal.
I didn't even think of that. So, I was always thinking of different types of data being in different types of databases, but you're saying too, you could even, depending on the access patterns, choose, you know, different databases for that. That's kind of interesting.
Right. And somebody I was talking to recently, they had a logging application and they needed to retrieve their logs like five different ways. Mm-hmm. So they stored it in five different Azure Table Storages because Azure Table Storage is really cheap. But like I said, you know, looking up on anything other than the key is slow.
Right.
So they made things with five different keys, you know?
Okay.
So that solved that problem. So even, you know, combining it with itself.
So, I mean, as a developer, you know, I like to think that I fit the mold that I'm a lazy developer. And, you know, to me, choosing one way to store things, quote, is easier. So how much harder is it to implement these in the different ways, either the different technologies or, like you said, five different Azure Table instances? You know, as a lazy developer, you know, we want to keep it simple. You know, how do we manage this complexity that this adds?
Mm-hmm. Well, as a lazy developer, you know, you still have problems that you want to solve, and it does add to the complexity. So I think you need a compelling reason. One of the things that I'm working on now is part of the record is going to be stored in Azure SQL because they need that strong transactional support, and that's going to be the document of record, and they can combine, you know, do your ad hoc querying and still get the IDs of all those records that would match a query. And then the unstructured part is going to be stored in DocumentDB. Mm-hmm. And they never know how many fields they're going to get, you know, how that data is going to be structured. So it's still, you know, that works out really well. And then you can combine those together. So that adds complexity, which, you know, makes it more difficult. But it simplifies that part of it. So as a lazy developer, that should appeal because you can just take all that unstructured data and dump it out into the document. You have a little more complexity with your repository, but you don't have to figure out how to organize your SQL tables so that you can represent that hierarchy when you don't even know what it's going to be up front.
That's always awkward.
So, yeah.
Yeah, so like on some recent projects that you've done, like what were the different database technology you paired together? So obviously SQL and Cosmos DB. I don't know if you have any other kind of iterations or you mentioned Redis as well. So was Redis in that same solution or what were some of the combinations?
SQL Server with DocumentDB. Mm-hmm. I worked on a proof of concept with the Gremlin app to store like relationships between entities because they're, you know, changing a lot and they're deeply nested. So if you want to find out, it wasn't people, but like, you know, friends of friends of friends, you know, you can get that.
Yeah.
So, you know, much more easily with Gremlin.
Yeah.
So you can add that to whatever else we're doing. In this case, it was SQL Server. So having the relationships then stored in Gremlin, you know, worked out really well.
And then, of course,
Azure Table Storage is like, you know.
Yeah, just, I could kind of add that on. Mm-hmm. Just like, because that would be similar to Redis, I would think, in many regards. So I would probably start with, you mentioned the repository layer, and I'm kind of wondering how your code is structured. So were you saying that the repository layer behind that, it's managing the databases? So like when I'm writing my logic in my code, would you normally say that I'm not thinking about which place I'm reading and writing the data to, or
yes.
Does it know? Okay.
If you're doing it right.
Yeah. So it's like I need to load up this customer and then I need to load the sales order. Like from that code, you know, those look like similar calls to you, but behind the scenes, one could be going from SQL and one is from Cosmos, for example.
Right. Behind the scenes. So you have, you know, a layer that behind the scenes will get the SQL part of that, get the DocDB part, and then combine them into one object and then deliver that to the front end.
Okay. Mm-hmm. That's pretty
cool. So it does make it a little more complicated, but it solves a really hard problem in SQL.
Yeah. Well, I like that. I mean, having that unstructured data in there where, you know, like extensible column support or this extensibility story, like that was, you know, to this day is like this really difficult thing, right? Where it's like I have 10 fields and I want to allow the customer to add them. But if you put them in the database, then, you know, good luck because now you've given them access to that and it's just terrible. But if I can just like throw that into Cosmos DB and have it keyed off of this over here, that sounds awesome to me. It sounds like it solves a big problem.
Mm-hmm. So when we're talking about especially like developers who may have had more like, SQL Server experience, when they're learning these other new technologies for storage, are they going to have to learn new patterns and practices in their code to kind of access them, or can they kind of reuse maybe some of that like repository pattern style of development that they may have used for a transactional database?
Oh, you could definitely set up, like I have a repository like for DocDB, and, you know, link queries work with DocDB, you know, so you can use a lot of the things that are familiar. Once you start getting into like Gremlin, then that gets a little bit different. So you have to, you know, work a little harder to make that fit the pattern than in your API.
Okay. So we shouldn't be too scared.
No.
Okay. Anything else that's top of mind that you wanted to mention? That's pretty cool.
Yeah.
Where can people find you online if they wanted to contact you?
The best way is through Twitter at Bougie Fever.
And we'll have a link to that in the show notes.
I love that. That's very good. Well, thank you so much for coming on the show. It was good
talking.
Thank
you for having me.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Carl.
Yeah.
Don't wait for users to report problems. Raygun gives you complete visibility on errors, crashes, and performance problems affecting your end users. Replicate issues in seconds rather than digging through log files or having to rely on users to report errors or crashes. Raygun gives you a window into how users are really experiencing your software applications, supports all major programming languages and platforms, and integrates with your current development workflow tools too. There's a free 14-day trial, and it takes minutes to implement. So start resolving issues in your application and check it out today at raygun.com.
We're talking to Walt Richer, a senior staff instructor at LinkedIn Learning and a Windows Development MVP for Microsoft.
Hey, how are you?
Good, good. So I'm trying to figure out if we work for the same company or not.
Do you work for Microsoft?
Yep, I work at Microsoft. So
I worked at LinkedIn in the part called LinkedIn Learning.
Okay.
And that is the formerly used to be lynda.com. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you know, Lynda got bought by LinkedIn. So Microsoft did buy LinkedIn, but mostly we're an independent company still. And we have the same LinkedIn structure we had before.
Yeah,
we have their own HR department and everything else, so it's really a separate company.
Okay, very cool.
So you're going to be giving a talk here later this week on data visualization.
I am.
So what kind of things are you going to be covering on that? Because when I hear that word, that to me, that's just like a lot of things pop into my head.
What pops into your head when you hear that?
Well, I think of stuff like charts and graphs. I also think of stuff like infographics.
Those are all great words, and I'm going to be talking about that. So my idea of this talk is that we have all this data sitting in our data warehouses and everywhere else. Every developer works with some sort of data. And I've been a front-end developer forever.
Mm-hmm.
And so part of our job as a front-end developer is to figure out how to take that data and make it interactive, to build the UI, but also sometimes it's just showing that data,
mm-hmm.
right? And so this talk focuses on the showing of the data. And in this talk, it's morphed. I've given this talk a lot at many different conferences, and it's morphed over time. But mostly I talk now about how the human brain and our optical system processes information. So I think that's fascinating. And so I start the talk by looking at how we perceive colors, how quickly your brain can find a nugget of information mm-hmm. inside a dense array of information.
Mm-hmm.
And so then once I've talked about that, then it helps the developers see, okay, if I've given three or four choices of doing a chart, which is a mm-hmm. simple type of data visualization, which is the most effective use of that? So that's mm-hmm. what I'm trying to pull out of it in the talk is what's... If our eyes see contrasts in shapes or colors, then how can we leverage that when you're showing the data?
Okay. So this is a little bit of a tangent, but I think it kind of applies. So, on my phone, I have tons of different apps. I have an app that tracks my exercise. I have an Apple Watch, which is putting things into Apple Health. I have apps that track my movement. And recently, I found out there. Scott Hanselman tweeted out this app for iOS and Android called Gyroscope. And literally all that does is it by itself doesn't do anything, but it taps into all those different other applications, the info that they have, and it visualizes it and brings it all together. So before, while I had my, how often I was going to the gym and what I was doing, I had my health,
and
my
heart rate. It was in a separate app, right?
And they're all in like four separate apps.
Right.
And
yeah,
each app kind of did. The raw data was there, but it wasn't useful to me. And it brings it together in this really nice way, this visual way, and just cross references it on each other. So I can really appreciate the work that's being done in this area.
Right. So I heard that podcast too, and I thought it was interesting because it sounds to me, and I may be wrong, they haven't looked at Gyroscope yet. Have you used it yet?
I've been using it for about 2-3 weeks now.
Okay. So is it basically like a aggregator then of all the data?
Mm-hmm.
And then yet you can, does it correlation between different pieces of data too?
Yeah. So you can see like that you were at the gym and your heart rate went up. So it can understand that and give you insight that like when you go to this place, that you're more likely to do exercise there. And it starts understanding that. And I haven't used it for long enough, but listening to that podcast that Hanselman did, that down the way they're going to be able to use that data to proactively tell you things. Because they can say, we know you're at this location. We know you're about to do exercise. Maybe there's something useful I can tell.
It's kind of amazing. Like you can go in there and like you said, the Apple Health app, and it'll say, hey, 3 years or three hours ago.
3 years ago.
Yeah, 3 years ago. Well, I think I have data going back to then. But, 3 hours ago, your heart rate was 59 beats per minute from, 9 to 9:15. And it's just like, okay, what am I supposed to do with that? So
yeah, that's awesome.
I think you're tapping into a great point, which is like that data by itself really isn't useful. It has to be visualized, right? And there's probably a million different ways to do it, all different purposes.
One of the things I say in my talk right at the beginning is that, we have all this data, but if you don't do anything with it, sure, there are legal reasons why we might need to gather data for different laws out there. But I call it inert data because it's just there occupying spaces on your hard drives, and what are we going to do with that? So my point is sometimes what you need to do with that is bring it out. Now we got all these analytic tools and business, we got BI and things like that that can aggregate that. My point in the talk is, now that you do this, is there some way you can show that to your user? And that's not always the right thing. Sometimes it's nothing more than just putting it in.
Lots of distractions here. Yeah. So you mentioned like some of these BI tools. So there's like obviously like Power BI and things like that. So, if I want to do data visualization, do you talk much about like what tools you should actually use?
In fact, I say that at the beginning of the talk. This is not a programming talk. This is about how the human optical system in the brain processes information. And I have 60 minutes, and even then I can't really get everything in.
That's really amazing. Yeah.
There's a lot to say. Like I could do 15, 20 minutes just on how the brain perceives color.
Yeah.
Instead, what I do is I have like a 3-minute segment, and what I try to pull out is accessibility. What is the one thing you can take away from this talk that makes your data more accessible as far as colors go? Because of Mesa, I bring up the color blindness issue.
Yeah, well, I'm colorblind.
Well, then you know.
Yeah.
And so tell me, and when are there times when you're looking at, say, a visualization of data and you just don't understand it?
Yeah, some of the colors will look the same. They use color to differentiate. So actually, if you look at I worked at GE years ago, and if you looked at their manufacturing software, you can actually do different patterns like dotted and dashed lines, and that was all because of me. So I would actually be the guy that they would come to me and say, like, here's the visualization we plan on doing. Can you tell this data apart? And if I couldn't, then they'd figure out how to make it so that they could, which was pretty cool.
So that was good, though, is that they had an advocate that they could bring the information to, and a lot of developers don't think through that process, and it's because I'm not colorblind. I don't need... Whenever we're not, we don't have the accessibility issue. I don't think we think about it unless somebody prods us.
Yeah, exactly. And actually, this is a little bit of a tangent, but I don't want to sound like I'm like advertising for Microsoft. But there is like this huge push within Microsoft. There's all these disabilities that that people don't see. You normally think like disability and it's like a person in a wheelchair or something, right? Or they're blind or hearing impaired or whatever. But there's actually this big push in the company to understand like it's really a spectrum. There's so many different things. Colorblindness just being one of them. But there's so many different types of impairments. It could be motion. It could be whatever, right? Like there's thousands of things that we could probably list off there. And having like those types of employees, first of all, so that you can actually build products that reach that wider audience. That was kind of an early thing that I ran into was that there. And then I'm sure there's different types of vision impairment where you have to make things bigger, or you just have to figure out a different way to visualize it because they're perceiving it different. And maybe even like dyslexia, I don't know if that changes like how people see charts. And
I went to a session, I think it was at an MVP summit a few years ago, and they did an accessibility thing. And the one thing that stood out for me that really helped me was the fact that a lot of us go through a temporary phase in our life where we're disabled. Like if you break your arm and suddenly you only got one hand and now you can't open that door.
But right? when you fix problems for people that have the permanent issues, you're also solving problems for people that have the temporal issues.
Which is what resonated with me in that talk, right? Is it? Mm-hmm. It's like, so you're not just, you're solving for one group of people, but it also benefits society as a whole.
And then you take that even further. So you have the person with the permanent, maybe they're missing an arm, somebody with a broken arm. Well, maybe somebody's just holding a bag of groceries and then they only have one arm available for a few seconds.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So not to like get even more on a tangent, but I don't know if you saw the creators update the fall creators update of Windows 10 now has the eye tracking support. I saw a demo of that. That was amazing.
I haven't seen that yet. Yeah. So tell me about that.
Yeah. So the guy, I mean, he was typing a sentence like at a pretty good clip. And he actually, as far as I know, didn't have a disability. He was actually just demoing the feature. And just by looking at the on-screen keyboard, and it actually had basically the swipe type functionality. He was looking at the keys and then doing the auto completion, looking at that. And he was actually able to type it like, I mean, it looked like, you know, 20 words per minute, 30, I don't know how fast it was. I was shocked at how fast it was. And somebody who does that all the time would get really proficient at that.
So I'm curious, is there an API for that then?
I would think so. I actually don't have a lot of knowledge of it, but I would think so.
That's I know right now that it requires special hardware. It only works with one specific eye tracker, but they're looking to make it so any kind of generic eye tracker will work with it.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so that'll be pretty cool. So getting kind of back on track, I'll just bring us back.
This is typical of most conferences, the way conversations go.
Well, yeah, exactly. I mean, there's so much cool stuff to talk about. Right. So one thing that I always find interesting in data visualization is deception. So trying to trick somebody with data. So one of the ones that I've seen before is, where like the scale isn't from zero. You know, and it's just like, I'm not going to call out anything specific, but, you know, like take like unemployment numbers or something, right? Where they show like this, you know, the bars are going and then all of a sudden there's like a big change and it's just like, whoa, look at this massive change. And then here, whenever you put it at zero, like all the bars are really equal.
Right. So basically you're clipping the scale and it distorts the numbers. You can either clip the vertical or horizontal scale either way. And I have a small section in my talk that deals with that. And I don't go into too much specifics, but my take on it is, sure, there are some people that will deliberately skew the statistics. My point is that we're trying to show the data, and if you don't understand how the brain works, you might inadvertently skew the data without realizing it.
Yeah,
right. Like hiding information in there because of colors, right, or the sizes of lines, or. I've got some section on that in the talk.
But, I mean, even those two topics are related. I mean, you can inadvertently skew because you have, like, a 3D pie chart, and just how it's rotated will make one section
looping. Have you seen my talk?
No, I have not seen your talk.
I do a 3D chart, and I say this is one of the reasons why this doesn't work. I do a 3D pie chart. Mm-hmm. And if you tilt it towards the... It tilts towards the user, and whatever pie segment's in front is always going to appear larger than it really is. Mm-hmm. You know, and so... The rule there is never use a 3D pie chart. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so that actually brings up a good point then. Like, so our listeners, this is going to get published, I think, after the conference, so they can't go see your session. What can they do? I mean, like, are there any, like, sort of basic rules that you can follow? So, I mean, you mentioned don't show it in 3D. I mean, should they try to make the data as bland as possible? I mean, that seems like a bad idea itself. Like, so are there any kind of like simple rules that they could potentially follow that will help?
There's one of the rules I have is to segment differentiate the data by what I call the 5 D's. And of course, I don't have my slides in front of me, so I don't remember what they are at the moment. But basically, it's color. So, like, if you're trying to differentiate, there's color, size, shape. And two more, which are escaping me at the moment. Mm-hmm. That's a takeaway.
So you kind of start with like the high level key components there, and if you understand those five key components, then you're going to be on the right track.
Yes.
Okay.
And then, as you mentioned at the beginning, I work for LinkedIn. I actually work for LinkedIn Learning, which is the training part of the company. Mm-hmm. And we have a lot of data visualization courses there that I didn't have anything to do with those courses, but the few that I've watched have been really good at bringing out this information.
Okay. I never really thought about that before. I mean, I suspect many people who are doing data visualization, I would think that the vast majority of them are sort of untrained, right? Like they're just, give me this line chart that does this thing.
Well, the fact that a chart is in fact a data visualization tells you that's true. How many business people do you know that use Excel that throw together a simple chart?
Yeah.
Of course, I'm speaking to an audience of developers and other people in the software industry, so I'm focusing more on the development side of it, even though I don't show code. But you're right, it's a simple chart. And again, you can make mistakes by putting too many bars in a bar chart.
Well, I've seen that before working for a company where they're like, we want this kind of chart and we want it to look like this. And it's not what they need, it doesn't help them, but that's what they've always had. So, you know, we need to recreate what we've always had because we've always done it that way. And we need to challenge that a little bit sometimes.
You do. And the nice thing is, I don't know if the nice thing is the right way of saying it, but there's a lot of new research happening in the last 20 years that builds on top of what we used to use in the chart world. In fact, there's all these new different kinds of charts out there, like something called the waffle chart, which when you show it, it's like, oh, well, of course, that's a simple concept. Basically, it's a pie chart that uses squares to represent the percentage. So you typically have 100 squares or rectangles. And so if you want to show 60%, 40%, 60 of the squares would be one color and 40 of the squares would be another. Yeah. So, but it doesn't suffer from the problems of pie charts because they're round. And so it's a simple, oh, that's easy. And it's easy to do with the kind of tech, you know, CSS and HTML or JavaScript or in our world, the WPF world. It's really easy to do that kind of UI.
Mm-hmm. That's very cool. Okay, so I guess the message of people is like, you know, if you're doing any kind of charting, like just spend even just a few hours like educating yourself, because it sounds like there's a lot you can learn in a short period of time.
Yeah, and there's a nice website out there. Because I don't have the URL here, mm-hmm. but I can get it to you. Do
sure.
you do show notes?
Yep.
Yeah, so
got
I'll get
them
it to
right
you.
Here.
Okay, so there's a JavaScript library, and there's a ton of samples. This one guy's done a ton of samples on the internet, and I'll get that link to you.
Sure.
And so there's all the basic things. There's like about 120 different kinds of charts there.
Mm-hmm.
And so you can, what I like to say is go there and see the different kinds of charts that people are making now. So one of these charts may pop into your brain and go, that's really the representation of the data that we're looking for. And I would have never thought of that.
Mm-hmm. Very cool. Okay. So where can people find you online?
I am at LinkedIn. Let's see, it's linkedin.com/learning/WaltRicher. That gets you to my pages on LinkedIn. Same thing at lynda.com. It's lynda.com/WaltRicher. And then also you can find me at my XAMLWonderland.com website. That's where my blog is.
Very cool. Well, thank you so much for coming on and talking about data visualization.
Thanks.
Right now we are talking to Scott Addy. He's a senior content developer for ASP.NET Core, and Cecil Phillip, who is a cloud developer advocate for Microsoft. Welcome, guys.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for having us on.
So you guys wanted to talk to us about docs.microsoft.com, especially for Node and what else?
For .NET.
And for .NET. So, you know, introduce us to that. You know, what's interesting about the docs for .NET and ASP Core?
Yeah, so we're trying to make, you know, sort of a one-stop shop for .NET developers. So you're not finding yourself sifting through loads and loads of documentation. This is sort of the landing page that you would begin with to discover the content you're looking for.
Right.
So we have this now for both .NET devs and Node.js devs, and I suspect that list will continue to grow.
Okay. Yeah, we had a show on docs that was more of like the technical architecture, but I don't think, Carl, we talked too much about the content, did we?
No, we didn't talk about it because, you know, like if we go to docs.microsoft.com right now, I mean, you essentially just pick your technology and it's a little bit different for each technology, isn't it?
It is.
So what's cool about your areas that you're talking about today?
Well, so my area is cool just because it's ASP.NET Core, let's be honest. But, you know, so on my team, if we look at that, there's about three of us right now producing those docs. And right now, there's a lot of buzz around this ASP.NET Core thing.
So you're saying we have this huge ASP.NET Core, and there's three people writing the documentation?
That's
for
correct.
Them.
Yep.
So no pressure.
No pressure. I don't lose sleep at night. That's a lie. Yeah, it's a big responsibility. And when you look at the ASP.NET docs, they're actually merged with ASP.NET proper documentation. Okay. So we do both ASP.NET proper and the new shiny ASP.NET core. Mm-hmm. So yeah, big responsibility.
And I'm assuming that's like anything on docs. So like if I see something that could be improved or I think I have like a better example for, I can click a button on the page and submit it that it'll eventually potentially become part of the docs as well.
Yeah, so that's the beauty of it. We actually just surpassed 500 contributors on the ASP.NET documentation
repo.
And
that's outside contributors?
That is mostly outside contributors.
Nice.
Which is pretty impressive. I've been pleased with the collaboration we've been able to establish with the community. It's a very easy process. You don't really even need to know Git or GitHub for that matter. Mm-hmm. It's as simple as navigating to the doc that you're interested in, clicking the edit pencil and just making the minor correction that you want.
I keep telling people that on the podcast. I mention all the time. I'm like, you don't have to worry about what a pull request is or anything. Just push the pencil button and start, change it, and then push the submit button.
You know what's really cool about it is that when you think about, hey, I want to learn a product, mm-hmm. the first place that you go to is the docs, right? And so if you go to the docs and there's not something that you want to find, or it's not something that, some information that's missing, mm-hmm. like you can just submit a pull request or you can edit it, create the doc yourself. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. We can have that conversation online on GitHub right now.
Yeah, exactly. I'm telling people to do that all the time. Fix the documentation. That's the easy way to kind of get started too.
Yeah.
Because that's like the in my mind, like the first step in becoming a contributor to a project is starting to edit the docs and then getting comfortable with that process. And then maybe you can actually start to make code edits as well.
Yeah, exactly.
I think a lot of people out there in the community think it's just the docs. If I make a small correction, who really cares? Mm-hmm. You'd be surprised. That does make a big impact. Mm-hmm. And when you talk about things like localization of the docs, translating that into several other languages, something like a misspelled word or a missing period or comma somewhere, that goes a very long way. Mm-hmm. Contributing extensively to the docs can actually lead to incentives too, like the MVP award program.
Right. That's a good point.
Mm-hmm.
You could be like Carl. So I'm wondering, what type of audience then is it geared toward? Because obviously there's people that are just getting starting with .NET Core. There are people that, would consider themselves expert, and then there's everything in between. So, how do you deal with that?
We definitely have to recognize that the audience is varied. Yeah. You need content for that beginner, where you really lower that bar, and you give them an end-to-end tutorial.
Yeah.
Here's what you need to install. Yeah. Here's how you do that.
Because those are the people that would get the frustrated, I think, the most, because it's like, I just want to get started with this stupid technology. Just tell me what to do. I'm always searching for the technology I want to use and tutorial. And I want to find somebody who has that page. It's just like, listen, just do this, run this command, and then you will be up and running. A lot of times I'm looking for that when I'm starting with the technology.
Right.
Yep.
So you have to have that. And then when I come back as the expert, then I'm looking for okay, I want to know exactly how this function works, how to call it, how it works. So how did you handle that? So do you have a page that says if you don't know how to use this at all, start here, and then experts kind of go over here? Or how did you structure that?
Yeah, so we have a table of contents that you would see over on the left-hand side of the webpage. There's an introduction node where you can begin if you're an absolute beginner. Beneath that, you'll see a tutorials node where you would find these end-to-end walkthroughs. But, to your question, we've also got to cater to that more advanced audience. If we're dealing with a power user, they're not going to read through one of those beginner-level tutorials. For them, we really need to produce these reference documents, things like API references that are, generated from the code base, or, just, again, reference material, not end-to-end tutorials.
Yeah.
So how are you guys also addressing the discoverability of docs.microsoft.com? I mean, I'm old enough. I remember you install Visual Studio from a disk and do you want to install the documentation? Then you grab the other disk and you put that in there as well. And then, after that, as things move to the internet, it's, msdn.microsoft.com. And
you
all
install
the documentation? back in the day I did.
It was a CHM file.
Yeah, it was great. You hit F1, and it opens.
I remember the F1 of horror, though, because he'd hit it and be like, opening documentation.
No. But still, I mean, that was a discoverability feature. And now we're moving a lot of people's mind share off of MSDN. So how are you guys working, one, on discoverability of the new docs, and two, migrating the people that are used to doing it, like going to MSDN and going to docs now?
I think that's where, you know, events like this are huge for us in promoting the docs platform. I'm talking to you guys right now about it. That's a form of discoverability. Right. Cecil's team will also be a big part in driving this and really raising awareness of the new docs platform. You know, we're taking pieces off of msdn.microsoft.com and placing them in the new docs platform.
Mm-hmm. But let's be realistic for a second. Like, I'm thinking that whenever I want to find something, I do a search for it, right? Yep. So it feels to me like your biggest thing actually would be you want to show up in the searches, right? I mean, so I guess I'll turn that into a question instead of making all these assumptions. So my question is, like, how many people just go to docs.microsoft.com versus like getting there through a search? I'm guessing most people get there through a search.
We do have telemetry that tells us this sort of thing. Yeah. I don't know the exact mix there in terms of percentages, but that is something we take a serious look at.
Yeah, because I'm just thinking of like Stack Overflow. Like, I never go directly to Stack Overflow. Like, I'm like, hey, it feels like a Stack Overflow day. I'm gonna go hang out there for a while. That doesn't happen, but like, it's in every search that I do. Like, it's almost always like the first result. I'm like, oh, okay, I know that site. I understand it, so I click on it. And it seems like, what I'd like to see is like Stack Overflow and docs.microsoft.com. Like, those should be my top two results for sure.
Right. And hopefully we want to get there, right?
Yeah.
You know, hopefully if you search for C# or you search for Azure, or you search for DocumentDB or something like that, like, our goal is to be, you know, we want to be the top of those searches.
Yeah.
You know, and I mean, in addition to just having text too, one of the things that you're going to see us push going forward is, you know, we want to have some more video type content. So not only will it be text, it'll be video. So there are different types of learning experiences for different types of folks.
Yep.
So maybe you might want to read the reference documentation. Maybe you want to just watch a really quick start video, right? So depending on who you are or the level that you're at, like, you have a couple different options that you can choose from.
Yeah. No, that's a great point, because I like to have the video like playing in the background while I'm doing my other research, because I sort of absorb it, you know, in the background there.
Well, so what's good with that is that you could have, like you said, you can have two monitors up. Right, and you can be doing, you know, following along in your second monitor while somebody's showing you how to walk through, you know, for instance, John Papa just did one on Cosmos DB and Node.js, right? So you could be following along with him while you're kind of like, you know, watching the video on the other screen.
Yeah, very cool, very cool.
Well, one of the things that you just made me think of, you know, there's the recent news that Stack Overflow, they had their document site, and they're going to be shutting it down. And what are you guys doing to make sure that you guys stay relevant in a way that people are actually using your documentation?
You know, we're definitely looking at that announcement very carefully, doing sort of a post-mortem.
Sure. Yeah. No, that's
what are some lessons learned from that so that we don't make the same mistakes ourselves?
I mean, that might be something a little bit hard for you guys, because you might not have all that telemetry to, you know, like, kind of back that up off the top of your head. But I mean, that's a very timely announcement to this discussion.
But Stack Overflow, like, they needed a reason to exist, right? Like, the document portion, they're just like, hey, maybe we can get a whole bunch of traffic out of this and make some money. I docs.microsoft.com, right? Like, it's not trying to make money, right? It's trying to support the things that bring in developers. So, I mean, it from that perspective, it's got to be a little bit different goal, right?
Yep. Yeah. If our docs are poor, we're not going to see the adoption of our products. So, exactly. I mean, that's really the face, the entry into the Microsoft developer ecosystem.
Okay. I did want to ask you something about the Node.js documentation. Like, if somebody's listening and they haven't done anything with Node.js, like, is our documentation actually a good place to start, do you think? Or should they get some experience with Node and then come over to our documentation?
I think if you're using Microsoft tooling, our docs would be a great place to start.
That's awesome.
You know, we try to be inclusive of all developers and not necessarily favor, you know, oh, you must use everything Microsoft to work with us. I think our Node.js Dev Center could be a great starting point. Mm-hmm. Yeah, if you dive directly into the Node.js docs, that could be a little intimidating.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And I think using like VS Code with Node.js is an awesome experience. So that's pretty cool that's a good place it can start. So what else are you guys working on?
So right now I'm really focused on the docs for the upcoming ASP.NET Core 2.0 release. I've been heads down on that quite a while.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I'm really excited about that release. Mm-hmm. That's been my focus.
So I'm pretty new. I've been at Microsoft maybe 2 weeks now.
Welcome.
So thank you. So my team has really been focused on the Azure Dev Centers.
Okay.
So the Azure.NET SDK for .NET and the SDK for Node.js. Specifically the documentation for those. So we just launched the two Dev Centers last week. So definitely recommend everybody go and check it out. You know, we have a few quick start videos that are up there, videos that we were speaking about a little while ago. So you could see how easy it is for you to get started in Azure using the SDKs and using some of the tooling that we've built.
Okay, so are those videos then on docs.microsoft.com or are they somewhere else?
If you go to docs.microsoft.com, you go to Azure, and you select .NET SDK or even the Node.js SDK, front and center right there on the page, you'll see a video and you could watch like first experience right there.
Okay, perfect. That's great. Because I don't want to have to like, there's like MVA, the Microsoft Virtual Academy, and there's like Channel 9. It's great when it's all integrated like that.
So
That's great to hear.
I think you'll probably start to see a tighter integration there. Channel 9 is actually part of the same division that we work in now.
Okay.
So if people want to find out more about you guys individually, where can people find you online?
Best place to reach me is Twitter. And my handle is @Scott_Addy. So my first and last name with an underscore in the middle.
Okay.
And same with me too. So I'm Cecil Phillip on Twitter also.
Okay, perfect.
And one more thing I'd like to add. Cecil, you have a podcast yourself. You want to get a plug-in for that?
Oh, I do. Thank you, man. So I do have a podcast. It's called Away from the Keyboard. I co-host it with my buddy Richie Rump. And it's a show where we talk about everything that happens away from the keyboard, right? So we talk about different folks about, you know, woodworking and playing video games.
Oh, that's cool.
You know, a lot of our guests do online courses or they write books and things like that. So, you know, I think it's really interesting to hear the story about the people that, you know, build the products we use every day. Because again, at the end of the day, like software is about people, right? So it kind of just makes sense that we try to understand the people that write our software.
Okay, so everybody hit stop, go subscribe to that. much better than this podcast.
Hey, well, we can listen to more than one podcast at the same time. Okay, right? So we can listen to everything on iTunes. Right?
That sounds great. Well, thank you guys so much for coming on and talking to us about the doc. So obviously, people can go to docs.microsoft.com and check it out for themselves. So thank you so much.
Thank you for having us on. Appreciate it, man.
Yep, thanks.
Thank you.